Can I invite to the stage, please, Father Mark Busco.
Well, thank you, Martin, for that nice introduction. It is good to be back with you. I'm really delighted to be here after some time. I've been spending a lot of time with Flannery O'Connor, so it's just been so great to be back in Greenland, I can't tell you. And when Martin said, could you do something on the second half of your book and just kind of contemporize that in some ways, I was excited about rereading some of Green's late stuff, but also looking at Pope Francis. So again, I'm really a pleasure to be here and excited to kind of give you my sense of where things are, at least, and your comments perhaps about that. So I guess it goes without saying that anyone who reads just a few novels of Green realize how important the Catholic Church and his work. Sometimes Catholicism, as you know, animates and even drives the drama in the characters of his stories. Novels like Brighton Rock, Power and the Glory, The Heart of the Matter, and Monsignor Quixote, to name just a few, you kind of see that. But even perhaps in the darkness or underneath, you might say, on the fringes of the story, the narrative sometimes has Green exploring the social and political machinations of justice in a world of wealth and exploitation. Novels like The Comedians and The Honorary Council, The Human Factor, and Dr. Fisher of Geneva or The Bomb Party. If one were to pick up his occasional writing from newspapers, magazines, and speeches now collected in various published editions, Catholicism is never far from the center of his concerns. True, Green's depictions of Catholicism varied over the years, and he suggested, especially in his later years, that it would be best to consider himself a Catholic agnostic. But there always remained one consistent belief about the church and everything that Green wrote. There's a wonderful picture of him. When it is doing its job, the church serves the poor, the sick, the underprivileged, the disenfranchised, the sinner. Indeed, Green's literary expression of Catholicism prefers sinners to saints. To use a phrase from the Catholic commentator Michael Novak, the church for Graham Greene is of the sinners, by the sinners, and for the sinners. Perhaps it is obvious then that Pope Francis, the Argentine, The Argentine Jorge Bergoglio is the pope that Graham Greene has always been hoping for. I have heard it myself in various Jesuit community gatherings and in journals, actually. I was just at Farm Street Jesuit Community having dinner, and we were talking just about this very much at dinner a couple nights ago, that he is in some ways perhaps Green's vision of a pope. As the first Jesuit pope, Pope Francis certainly would have sparked Green's interest. In a letter written to the Jesuit priest Alberto Huerta in January 1991, months before his death, Green expresses his affection for the Society of Jesus. Quote, really, the only link I feel I have with the Catholic Church is with the Jesuit order. On the other hand, and I can imagine this, Green positively could be astonished by some of the first homilies that Pope Francis gave, when he said, not even 2 weeks into his pontificate, quote, in this day and age, unless Christians are revolutionaries, they are not Christians. And finally, who doesn't hear the resonance of Green's Catholic faith in Pope Francis' vision when he says, I see the church as a field hospital after battle. It is useless to ask a seriously injured person if he has high cholesterol and about the level of his blood sugars. You have to heal his wounds. Then we can talk about everything else. Heal the wounds, start from the ground up. The church as field hospital, a fitting metaphor for Green's sense of the role of the Catholic Church in the political and cultural upheavals of late modernity, especially in Latin America. Green never shied away from naming and engaging the darkness of our times. And I think Pope Francis would echo Green's belief that the world is not black and white, but black and gray. I have to say, I use that in homilies almost every single year, and everyone comes up to me and says, oh my God, who said that? I said, Graham Greene. But it's true. It's not a pure world. It's not black and white. It's black and gray. Today I want to dig a bit deeper into this comparison, first by giving a historical context to Green's own engagement with Latin America, the continent from which Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio was called halfway around the world, as he says, to become Pope Francis. Second, I want to suggest ways that Green's own Catholic imagination, like that of Pope Francis, was deepened in the post-Vatican II experience of the Church. And finally, I want to offer some convergences, intellectually, spiritually, even stylistically, that I think are at the heart of the matter between them, to coin a phrase. For I think green is the color palette of this present papacy. But first, a brief outline of just how engaged Green was in the issues and expressions of Catholic faith, especially in the last half of his long, productive life of writing. It's now commonplace in any study of Green to come down on one side or the other about how his Catholicism is either a help or a hindrance to his greatness as an author. Those critics uncomfortable with the way Green's religious imagination seems to impinge upon his novels tend to dismiss it as some sort of pathology, a neurotic outgrowth of his repressed childhood. They take Green to task for obscuring the humanism with God and religion. Those who see his religious imagination as central to his talents argue that Catholicism heightened the awareness of the tragedy of modern life, transforming his stories into supreme works of art. Whatever the case may be, Green disliked being called a Catholic novelist. He strove to disavow that label, as we all know, and I think he'd be more comfortable with Christian humanists. For, like we heard this morning, like all good literature, his art tended to encourage readers to acknowledge and attend to the humanity of others, to enter a fictional world in order to experience the human factor in the mystery of politics and culture. What is certain is that Green was profoundly moved by the central role that the developments in Roman Catholicism played in economically poor nations of Latin America. What started as an intellectual conversion in 1926 would become, in this remote part of Mexico, an emotional commitment to his faith. Here, the properties of his most famous novel, The Power and the Glory, would begin a sustained fascination with the religious and political aspirations of Latin American countries. Green's personal visits to Central and South America brought him into direct contact with oppression, economic disparity, violence, and the sinister shadow of superpower interference, all of which had been ignored, I think, or even unknown to many of his first world readers at the time. His travels brought him into contact with numerous nuns, priests, and committed Catholics who had dedicated themselves to working with the poor in order to surmount overwhelming injustices. If the political and economic oppression endemic to the region had not changed much in the decades since Green's time in Mexico, the Catholic Church indeed had definitely undergone a revolution of sorts. The paradigm shifts in Catholic thinking during the Second Vatican Council are boldly proclaimed in the 1965 document Gaudium et Spes. The joy and the hope, the grief and anguish of the people of our time, especially of those who are poor or afflicted, are the joy and hope, the grief and anguish of the followers of Christ as well. Green followed the developments of his faith, sensitive to both progressive and conservative movements alike. He admired the more liberal German Father Hans Küng, underlining in his own copy of Küng's On Being a Christian that, quote, Christianity and humanism are not opposites. Christians can be humanists, and humanists can be Christians. Christianity cannot properly be understood except as radical humanism. On the other hand, Green was unabashedly conservative in his complaints about the liturgical changes that had transpired since the council. He missed that old Tridentine Mass, the Latin Mass. He was praiseworthy of Pope Paul VI, who told Green not to worry about the power and the glory being put on the index of forbidden books because it was, quote, odd and paradoxical. Actually, we found out later that Montini, when the Pope was still a cardinal, He wrote a letter of basically defense of the novel in the 1950s when it was put on there, saying, "Listen, he's a Catholic writer. He's big in London. You don't want to put this on the index of forbidden books." But alas, it didn't work. So when he got to be Pope, he could easily say, "Oh, don't worry about that." He, of course, was not a big fan of Pope John Paul II, or at least the John Paul II in the last part of his in the 80s, late 80s. He found John Paul a bit of a disaster, actually, when it came to his treatment of liberation theologians of Latin America. So for when in 1984, when Green received a letter from Cardinal Paulo Evaristo Arns of Sao Paulo, one of the great leaders of liberation theology, a bishop cardinal who really defended it and nurtured it, the cardinal had sent a letter praising Monsignor Quixote. And Green responded with delight that His Eminence had enjoyed the novel so much. Green, in turn, offered his best wishes to the cardinal for the many years he had worked among the poor in Sao Paulo, ending the letter by noting, quote, "I have spent a good deal of my time in Latin America, and I want to thank you for all that you have done for human rights and for liberation theologians. Latin America has been the sphere where the Catholic Church has shown its very best side." By the time the phrase "a faith that does justice" had become the clarion call of liberation theologians throughout the continent, Green was approving greatly this solidarity with the poor, and he offered his moral and his financial support to religious and political organizations throughout the region, donating his royalties from Spanish translations of his works, both to monasteries and to political parties alike. This was, quote, "the best side of his professed faith," he said. He said, "We're, quote, we see Christianity as it always should have been, with the church actively involved in the struggle of justice." It is easy to forget just how much time and artistic time Green devoted to Latin America, just as Jorge Mario Bergoglio was being made the father provincial of the Jesuit order in Argentina in the 1970s. During this time, Green was next door, actually, in Chile, during that short-lived government of the Marxist president, Dr. Salvador Allende, optimistically writing of his experience in an article published shortly before General Pinochet's military coup. He said, quote, 80 priests, nearly all of them are working in the slums, have signed a declaration in support of socialism," unquote. He recounts an ecumenical service in the church cathedral attended by the Archbishop, President Allende, and the representatives from communist embassies, all listening intently as the priest urged everyone, quote, to expel the cane inside of him. Humility is necessary to recognize the homicide inside of us. It is easier to declare that the aggressors are outside, unquote. We also know Green was in Panama in 1976 and many times afterward, the guest of General Omar Torrijos Herrera, a charismatic leader who assumed military coup in 1968. We all know that part of that came into a memoir, getting to know the general, the story of an involvement. Torrijos was the first leader of Panama who came from the barrio. He opened schools and instituted a range of social and economic reforms. And it was from Panama that Green would kind of use as his base to keep up with what was going on in both Nicaragua and El Salvador. In 1983, Green visited Nicaragua as the personal guest of the two priests who were both cabinet ministers in the Sandinista government. One of them, Father Ernesto Cardenal, was a celebrated Nicaraguan poet. He just died recently. And he was head of the Ministry of Education in the fledgling Marxist state. Green would write editorials in support of the Sandinistas during this time, noting that the Catholic priests like Cardinal that were in the government freed it from the heavy Marxist ideology of a communist state. As the Vatican began to take issue with political protests and political priests throughout Latin America, Green offered his own nuanced objections. So after Pope, now Saint, John Paul II, visited Nicaragua and was publicly scolding Father Ernesto Cardinal in this picture, Green felt obliged to counter in an editorial page. Quote, "I think the Pope made a mistaken parallel between Nicaragua and Poland. The priest's presence in the government of Nicaragua is a kind of guarantee against a completely Marxist state. Unlike Poland, there had been a civil war. Nicaragua was more like the position in France at the end of the war, when Catholic and communist resistance who had been working together were both represented in De Gaulle's government. It is desirable that they should continue to work together. That dreadful scene on television when the Pope waved aside Father Cardinal as he knelt to kiss his hand shows that he does not realize Father Cardinal's importance to his people. He is not only a priest, he is their greatest poet. No wonder there was a disturbance at the Pope's Mass, unquote. Green saw that liberation theologies as a movement brought to the fore Latin American struggles, the way the religious and the political could interpenetrate to, in effect, a humanizing change. It was precisely because Latin America was overwhelmingly Catholic that the struggle would not be about the ideological battle between atheism and secularism, but the battle for economic and social justice. Green witnessed this firsthand. Quote, he says, "I have just returned from Nicaragua, and I can only speak of what I saw. Big placards displayed on the roads marked, 'Revolution, yes, but Christian.'" It kind of sounds like this morning when we had our speaker speak about, you know, the communist and Catholic funeral. I think Green would have loved that. So for the first time, I think Green thought that Catholicism's cultural and ritual significance in the lives of the poor could be a vehicle for authentic political change. The two foundational supports of Green's literary vision, religious faith and political involvement, could be intertwined in a new way, bringing a new religious breath to the final decades of his literary career. Of course, there is one more major convergence that colors Green's Catholicism in the age of Pope Francis, the nation of Argentina, and Jorge Luis Borges, the other Jorge. Green had visited Buenos Aires often and absorbed the comedy and the tragedy of Argentinian society. When he visited, he often stayed at the Lancaster Hotel on Cordoba Avenue and had been there a frequent guest many times of the Argentine writer and intellectual Victoria Ocampo. From this vantage point, Green began The Honorary Council, the novel that he preferred to all his others. Set mostly in the obscure border town of Corrientes, Argentina, this tragic comedy story is well known to us Green readers. A group of would-be revolutionaries who intend to kidnap the American ambassador as he toured their nearby Jesuit ruins, bungle the job, ending up instead with the rather drunken British Honorary Council in the area. They hold the Honorary Council hostage while waiting for their demands to be met by the Paraguayan dictator, General Alfredo Stroessner, who couldn't be bothered because he was on a fishing trip in Patagonia. The novel centers on the relationship of these three men, Eduardo Plar, a doctor who helps the poor and is kind of lured into the kidnapping scheme under duress, Leon Rivas, a revolutionary ex-priest who is in charge of the kidnapping but doesn't want to hurt anyone, and the honorary counsel, Charlie Fortnum, the irrepressibly drunken expatriate chattering away about the proper measure of whiskey. All three men, interestingly, are lapsed Catholics, modern-day exiles from both faith and a place to call home, in search of an identity that is at once personal, political, and religious. They each, in their own way, become reluctant heroes of their story. Green dedicated the honorary council to this Argentine host, Victoria Ocampo, quote, "With love and in memory of the many happy weeks I have passed at San Isidro in Mar del Plata." On one of his many excursions to Ocampo's home, Green was to meet Jorge Luis Borges, a man whom he admired greatly. In a short published memoir after Borges' death, Green recounts that he was once dispatched by Ocampo to pick up the famous writer at the National Library in Buenos Aires and to lead him to her home because of Borges' blindness. Green remarks that they spoke together about G.K. Chesterton and the prose of Robert Louis Stevenson. He vividly recalls how Borges had recited to him in perfect English a long poem by Stevenson. Watching Borges, Green remembers, quote, "I looked at his eyes as he recited, and I was amazed at the expression in those blind eyes. They did not look blind at all. They looked as if they were looking into themselves in some curious way, and they had great nobility." Any reader familiar with Latin America's history sees some of the properties of Borges's writing writ large in Green's conception of both, the Argentinian soul. Borges had a nostalgia for the gauchos of the past, and Green kind of parodies and makes fun of that in the novel. These gauchos are these brave and unruly kind of cowboys, kind of part of the folklore of the country. And he loved how Borges played on the lingering stereotypes of the hyper-machismo Latin American culture, which again, Green parodies in the novel. Within the honorary council, Green has various characters discuss the works of Borges, also reflect on the quality of detective fiction, and gloss stories on Stevenson and Chesterton. I just find that fascinating. So faith, doubt, belief, unbelief, political commitment, they play out in this drama in a Green-like fashion. So it is perhaps here, talking about Jorge Luis Borges, that we can pivot to another Jorge, the young Jorge, Jesuit Jorge Mario Bergoglio. In 1965, when Borges was 66 years old and Bergoglio was just a 28-year-old new Jesuit priest teaching in a school, the young Jesuit teacher of literature invited Borges to meet with two groups of his secondary school students. I bet thousands of literature professors from prestigious universities would have given anything to be in Bergoglio's position. It's said that even Bergoglio shaved him for class beforehand, so there was something almost intimate in having Borges there for the week. I think it was probably Bergoglio the Jesuit more than Bergoglio the teacher that made Borges agree to this. Perhaps it was the possibility for Borges to encounter a conversation between agnosticism and faith that motivated his interests. Bergoglio went to pick him up from the station after the six-hour journey by train from Buenos Aires. And as one former student in the class said in a recent interview about it, Bergoglio had a strict and methodical preparation of Borges' stories and poems, and it was not easy for them as high school kids. The former student says this, quote, "Maybe that was what won Borges over. He did say on a number of occasions, even to me personally, that what had surprised him, fascinated him almost, is that the teens like us had read so many of his works. Borges must have been aware that a group of young people could only have grasped a little bit of his reading, but only through this methodical and well-planned guidance did we know what he was talking about. It must have brought him great joy to learn that a handful of secondary school pupils, not students from an academic environment, as he would have expected, had been introduced to his works and were reading, studying, and discussing it," unquote. It is around the love of literature, then, that we can see some insight into perhaps a Green Bergoglio vision of the world. It is through literature and the arts that both men plummeted the depths of the human condition. We should note that, you know, Pope John Paul II and Benedict XVI arrived in Rome with a clearly marked intellectual corpus. John Paul, the philosopher, Benedict, the theologian. Not so Francis. In fact, I would argue that it is neither philosophy nor theology that focalize this pope's theological imagination. Rather, literature and art are the coalescing forms that shape his theology and philosophy. We now know that Bergoglio taught the works of Borges, but he also taught Mario Vargas Llosa, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and many others. In interviews in his first year of the papacy with various journalists, he revealed his love for his Italian heritage. In 2013, he said he had read Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed three times and was reading it now for a fourth. He admired the medieval poet Dante, but also the 19th century poet Nino Costa. He prefers the Italian neorealism of films like Rome, Open City, and La Strada. Expanding his literary horizon, he names Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground and Brothers Karamazov on the one hand, and a British writer, Robert Hugh Benson's dystopian novel, Lord of the World, on the other, as some of the novels that most affected him. It's fascinating to me how many times he's mentioned these two novels in interviews and in homilies. Pope Francis referred to Benson's Lord of the World when he warned about ideological colonization, what he called, quote, the globalization of hegemonic uniformity. He advised reporters on a plane to read it, and I have to say that was my clue to pick it up too and to read it, because I thought, if this is what he's talking about and I'm supposed to be some kind of like big guy in Catholic literature, why haven't I read Benson's book? My point here is that literature and poetry seem to ground Pope Francis's Catholic imagination in a markedly different manner than his predecessors. I think this love of literature feeds his desire to communicate in the language of story, of small anecdotes of human life, and with a directness that has become a hallmark of both his homilies and even his papal pronouncements. He sees art and its performance as concrete and particular manifestations of humanity's hunger for meaning. One might consider how Bergoglio's own history during the dirty war in Argentina sounds kind of like a character or a drama right out of a Graham Greene novel. When he was named the Jesuit provincial at a very young age, at the height of the Argentine conflict, where there were already 30,000 people disappeared from society, Bergoglio lived through dictatorship, and he had to learn how to negotiate his religious duties in the midst of a repressive political climate. Loyalty and disloyalty seems to be part of the equation of that life. Though Bergoglio has often acknowledged that he had made, quote, hundreds of errors when he was the Jesuit order's provincial, unquote, he still gets called on the carpet by critics that for failing to do more against the military regime. And yet, since he has become pope, scholars and historians have been going back and reassessing Bergoglio's role as Jesuit provincial during that difficult and dangerous time. We now know, that we didn't know because he never said anything about it in his own life, we now know that Bergoglio as Jesuit provincial personally shuttled and smuggled out of Buenos Aires both liberationist seminarians and priests, as well as communist professors and journalists in midnight runs into the countryside of neighboring Uruguay. Again, right out of a Graham Greene novel. Again, during his time at Provincial, two of his own Jesuit brothers, both of whom had been his former teachers, refused to leave their work among the poor in the capital slums, even after safety concerns were raised and clear instructions were given by the Provincial himself. Bergoglio rejected them from the order for disobedience. But when the two priests were later picked up by the secret police and taken to a torture chamber, we now know, but we did not know when he became pope, that he went to work on getting them released. He even went so far as to rather deviously switch places with a military priest in order to celebrate Mass in front of the generals and their families in charge of the dictatorship, all in the hope and service of having the two ex-Jesuits released. He was successful. So with historical hindsight, most critics now assert that Bergoglio's public silence during the Dirty War was actually probably enabled him to save more lives, using back channels to create a logistical network to protect those who had been targeted for elimination by the military. Again, I don't know about you, but the Bergoglio of the 1970s sounds to me like one of Greene's fictional priests, or could be, carefully treading the tightrope of divided loyalties and his vocation to attend to the individual over the political realities swirling around him. Perhaps then we can see how much these two men have in common. If Greene explores the connection between Catholicism and communism, he does it in order to examine inequality and injustice. If Pope Francis explores the connection between Catholicism and liberationist movements, he does it for the same reason, assessing the relationship of religious thought with political and social reality. Francis boldly claimed in 2015 that, quote, politics, according to the social doctrine of the church, is one of the highest forms of charity because it serves the common good. A good Catholic meddles in politics, unquote. That's a far cry from Joseph Ratzinger, who, as Benedict XVI proclaimed just a few years earlier, that, quote, "wherever politics tries to be redemptive, it's promising too much," unquote. In light of this commitment to the particularities of the world, it comes as no surprise that Bergoglio took Francis of Assisi as his papal namesake. Before he was announced as Pope Francis, the story goes, a fellow cardinal in the conclave offered then-Cardinal Bergoglio some simple advice. Don't forget the poor. Pope Francis has tried then to live up to this new name as a man of poverty, a man of peace, and a man who loves and protects creation. So as I bring my remarks to a close, I wanted to suggest a few last comparisons, for I see many intellectual convergences in their biographies. First, both Green and Bergoglio were drawn to the theological imagination of the French Catholic literary revival. Green, as you see on the left-hand side, would go through all of French Catholic literature. We know in his collected essays he writes on Léon Bloy, Charles Péguy, François Mauriac, Georges Bernanos. Bergoglio, in both theology studies before ordination and in his unfinished dissertation after he was kind of kicked out of Argentina, immersed himself in the French theologians, the Jesuit Lyonnais, as they say, Henri de Lubac, Gaston Festard, and later Hans Urs von Balthasar. The central theological aesthetic of this movement, found in the theological imaginations of artists and scholars, argues that God's grace builds upon nature and can be revealed in nature, that the face of God is visible in the lowest places, the most battered concerns of the world, or what Francis calls today on the periphery of society. For both the writer and the Pope, Catholic faith means an explicit concern for the poor and for the plight of those dehumanized by the economic and military realities they face. Second, both Green and Pope Francis are critical of capitalism. There is no such thing as a free market, nor is there anything sacred about markets. Pope Francis's phrases the problem as capitalism without a conscience. That's what he sees happening today. If Green despaired of American capitalism as this new imperialism taking over the globe and its lack of concern for the poor, Pope Francis will argue that, quote, capitalism gives a moral cloak of inequality. Both men are highly critical of the excesses of global capitalism. Pope Francis is merely continuing a line of Catholic social teaching that has existed for more than a century, one embraced by Green during his Catholic conversion in the 1920 Catholicism. I speculate that when he met B. Jarrett, who became a very good friend of the family, that in some ways he learned about a different way of economic reality that was very much fit into the Catholic ethos. Father Bede was not only godfather of Green's daughter, Lucy Caroline, but instructed his wife, Vivian, prior to her reception in the church. And he had two important works, Medieval Socialism and Social Theories in the Middle Ages, which really kind of gave an alternative kind of a vision of an economic kind of system for culture. I'm sure that these must have given some comfort to Green as a religious frame of reference to engage the way Catholic social teaching is weary of making capitalism an idol. Third, both Green and Pope Francis are interested in the interiority of the soul, or for Green, we might call the character's inner life. Francis would appreciate the way Green draws his characters, rejecting any suggestion that a person's appearances or actions or words adequately reveal the contents of a human heart. Is this not fundamental to so many of Green's works? The Heart of the Matter, The Quiet American, The Human Factor, to name just some obvious few. Only with such an interiority can one find compassion, sympathy, even mercy. One work of Pope Francis that I recently read, called The Name of God is Mercy, would, I think, have touched Graham Greene's imagination. At least as I was reading it, I was thinking of Graham Greene. This is the central teaching of Francis's papacy and takes me back to Brighton Rock, to that moment when the priest says to Rose, "The church does not demand that we believe any soul is cut off from mercy. You cannot conceive, nor can I, of the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God." I end with one final consideration. Green's Monsignor Quixote, for in many ways, as I think is the crowning achievement in this comparison between Pope Francis and Green. For in this novel, we move from the political to the mystical much more explicitly. It's a difficult thing to do, given our penchant for a seedier side of Greenland. I would argue that there is a new development in this work. I know some would disagree with me, but I think stylistically and thematically, it's not just a mere coda to Green's Catholic cycle. It's not just something of, oh, here's a man in old age. It is vintage Green, placing politics and religion in a dialogue of friendship between a misguided but saintly Spanish priest and a disgruntled communist mayor. Dialogue. I think that's where Green and Francis converge. It's the key to Pope Francis's papacy. He says, quote, the soul of dialogue, this is Pope Francis, the soul of dialogue is mutuality, seeking truth together. Dialogue is its own end, Pope Francis would say. Dialogue puts winning on hold, resists the zero-sum game of competition that infects both religion and politics. This, I think, is at the heart of what makes Green and Pope Francis remarkably similar to me. Green reaches this insight artistically in this novel of his late years, just as Pope Francis has nurtured this in his years of friendship with Argentine Rabbi Abraham Scorca of Argentina, who's now his friend, and perhaps even today, Greek Patriarch Bartholomew. This sense that they are equals in the dialogue, they are equals as friends. See, do I make sure? There's a great moment in Monsignor Quixote. After the priest and mayor have drunk a great deal and admit doubts concerning the absolute authority of their respective faiths, Father Quixote is especially troubled by the doctrine of hell, we know, and eternal damnation. And it goes like this, quote, I try not to doubt, the mayor said. Oh, so do I. And that we are certainly alike. The mayor put his hand for the moment on Father Quixote's shoulder, and Father Quixote could feel the electricity of affection in the touch. It's odd, he thought, as he steered Rocinante with undue caution round a curve, how sharing a sense of doubt can bring men together, perhaps even more than sharing a faith. The believer will fight another believer over a shade of difference. The doubter fights only with himself. The sheer experience of doubt opens up a dialogue of the soul as both characters question and examine their different paths, different faiths. Quixote and Sancho learn to understand, respect, and love one another. Pope Francis, while still Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, said something remarkably similar in his dialogue that was on TV and radio for over 6 years with Rabbi Scorca. It was this Jewish and kind of Christian dialogue. Bergoglio says this, quote, the great leaders of the people of God were men that left room for doubt. He that wants to be a leader of the people of God has to give God his space. Therefore, to shrink, to recede into oneself with doubt, the interior experiences of darkness, of not knowing what to do, all of that ultimately is very purifying. The bad leader is the one who is self-assured and stubborn. One of the characteristics of a bad leader is to be excessively normative because of his self-assurance. I think this is certainly a statement Green would find comfort in. In his university address in Hamburg in 1969 on the virtue of disloyalty, he rephrases the paradox of doubt in terms of the temptations to blind loyalty. Quote, the writer is driven by his own vocation to be a Protestant in a Catholic society, a Catholic in a Protestant one, to see the virtues of the capitalist in a communist society, of the communist in a capitalist state. He stands for the victims, and the victims change. Loyalty confines you to accepted opinions. Loyalty forbids you to comprehend sympathetically your dissident fellows. Be disloyal. It's your duty to the human race. Green, I think, of course, is talking about creative disloyalty or a disloyalty that goes beyond the superficial, not disloyalty for its own sake. It is the same premise as Pope Francis's concern that we resist any dialectic in which ideological abstractions drive out the particular concerns of particular human beings. Once the universal, be it truth or law or doctrine, drives out the human concrete realities and pastoral complexities of life, then you sin against mercy and the faith, right? Which is always going to be attentive to the concrete and the particular. As Pope Francis likes to say over and over again, reality is superior to the idea. That's a sense of reality that I find appealing. And this is much of what Pope Francis has been saying for the past 5 years. Things like calling the church a field hospital for the wounded of the world, or for calling for a jubilee, a holy year of mercy, or of all the anecdotal homilies known for their concreteness and closeness to the lived experience of people, or his prophetic call against the technocratic paradigms of globalization, and finally his call for the church to be at the peripheries as the way to grasp the drama of history, its fault lines and its points of rupture. In the end, I think, green is the preferred palette of this current pope. Both men demonstrate how Christian love really works. It's never about playing it safe, whether it's politics or love or God. I like to imagine that had Green lived to see this papacy, he might have found not only comfort in it, but in Jorge Mario Bergoglio, he would also have found great fodder for his next novel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for a rigorous, systematic, and really quite wide-ranging consideration of the role of and place of the work of Green in relation to Pope Francis and vice versa. I think that was quite original and a quite new way of thinking about some of the work of our present Pope. And the idea that literature has redemptive qualities is generous and enabling and empowering and resonates well with this morning's talks and looks ahead as well towards tomorrow's talks too, which John and Beatrice will give. I'm sure you have questions. Has anyone got a question for Mark, please? John.
Thank you, Mark. Enjoyed it very much. You alluded to Pope John Paul II's disapproval of vain people being involved in politics. Mm-hmm. When I worked in the Congress, that specifically applied to Robert Drynan and right. Another Jesuit priest from Wisconsin. I can't remember his name mm-hmm. right now, but they had to leave. Now, Pope Francis, you indicated that takes a different view. Do you think that some of your fellow Jesuits in the United States might run?
I hope not. I just hope not. we're at a difficult time in our country in the dysfunctionality of government, and I don't think that Jesuits would be very helpful right now. It would be more more polarizing. When there's a Jesuit chaplain for the House right now, and he was supposed to finish out his term, which is coming up, and he was asked to leave earlier, and he was very upset, and this made all the news. You probably didn't hear it about here, but it was very interesting because it was a polarized thing because there were some in the Congress as well. We really want to have a chaplain who's married so he understands, you know, married people. And of course, it's just such an anti-Catholic thing to say, you know. A lot of people come said, Catholic priests come from families, they actually know people, and they have, you know, it's not like they're, but there was this polarization of left and right, conservative and liberal, and so I think this Jesuit's going to serve out his time, and I think we just want to be under the radar for about a decade.
Thanks.
I'm a son of a pacifist farmer who was raised in a secular. It never occurred to any of us that there was ever a God. Whatever there was had evolved, humankind had evolved from other creatures, less intelligent creatures, and it was our business to make sure that they were still going to be around to keep us going for as long as they were. Now I mean, and which was originally the conception of the Enlightenment and the whole notion of what originally was communism was supposed to have been about. The awkwardness was that some people took up arms in the cause of communism, which meant that the whole thing just became no better than... I'll pick one. These, I think, I always thought that these were the preoccupations of Graham Greene. How do we teach the next generation to lead a good life? And the Catholic Church did its best to do that. It's still doing its best to do that, but it can't do it because it denies the fact that humankind. It doesn't start off from the fact that humankind. All of humankind evolved from another bunch of creatures that we've still got to cultivate, we've still got to look after, we've still got to cherish in a way that the Catholic Church looks down on rather than embraces, if you don't mind me saying. It treats us like a notion of charity, like you said, rather than the fact that that's what we all have to do. If we don't, that's not an act of charity. That's how we must learn to lead our lives. We have to share whatever there is. And I do worry. And the works that Robin Lustig mentioned this morning. I'm sorry, I'm going on, but the novelists, on the whole, they try to address that notion of humanity, of humankind, of compassion, of what they used to call every man, but then you don't call it every man these, because it's women as well. But that's really why art, literature, it reflects that truth, if you like, the humanity of humankind, which embraces all of humankind, beyond all conception of religion, in my view. And I can't think of another writer, with the possible exception of Dickens, that addressed that so clearly, so compassionately, so in such a tortured fashion, in other words, a conflicted fashion, that Graham Greene did. That legacy of his, I don't think, has been picked up by any writer in the same sort of way, neither journalist nor a novelist. Anyway, that was a long contribution. I'm sorry about
Thank
that.
Thank you. I'm not sure there was a question in there, but I would say...
Because I
would like to respond with one thing. This is my personal thought on Graham Greene. He's not interested in being good. He's not interested in the moral quality of goodness. He's interested in being saved and being redeemed. And that is a spiritual and theological. So I think that all of his characters are these great sinners, these great people who have broken lives and have done some terrible things, killing people, kidnapping people. If it was just a moral story, I think that Greene would be kind of bored with it, personally, my reading. I think that he's really interested in the drama of a cosmic story, and that means a religious story, and that means a story that has a place to stand where God is there. So that, I'm just responding to you.
Thank you. Okay, Beatrice. Yes, go ahead, please, John.
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. The Jesuit order was founded as a global reforming movement by St. Ignatius of Loyola, who was a great writer and communicator. I was just wondering whether Graham Greene, to your knowledge, had a particular relationship with St. Ignatius of Loyola and with his writings.
I don't know that much. I've done some research of what Jesuits have written to him and then he's written to. So I know that there were Jesuit confessors and friends throughout his life and that he was certainly going to be amenable to some of that. And then when Philip Caraman was his, I'm not sure if they did the spiritual exercises, this kind of imaginative way in, but you could see how any artist would find facility with Ignatius's kind of spiritual vision, because it is one in which you use the senses, where your imagination is to be trusted, not to be, you know, doubted, as a place to find God. And so it was the imagination, it's the imaginative contours. Put yourself at the foot of the cross. Put yourself at the birth of Christ. Put yourself on the Sermon on the Mount. Feel, smell, taste.
I'm not sure, I've never found anything like that. I do know that he had some profound letters with C.C. Martindale, who was a Jesuit at Farm Street. I know of his troubled relationship with Philip Caraman. He wasn't a big friend of Martin Darcy, but he went to dinner with him a lot when Evelyn Waugh invited him. And then, of course, he had a different priest at the end of his life. But so I really don't know if he doesn't really talk about Ignatius that much that I can remember in anything, except that there is a kind of a trajectory of having a Jesuit walk with him at difficult times throughout his life.
Great. Mike, we have a question from Beatrice at the front, please.
Just a comment about what you just said. There might be, something there, considering that, Unamuno's reading of Don Quixote de la Mancha in Vida de Don Quixote y Sancho, St. Ignatius is very present there, and as you know, Green really loved, that
You're
that
absolutely
book
right.
Unamuno.
No, Beatriz, she is, that's a good correction. He was familiar with the St. Ignatius of Unamuno, for sure. Yeah.
My question is something totally different. I was very interested in the connection you established between Green and Jorge Luis Borges. Because, I'm convinced that, to some extent, the honorary consul is a rewriting of one of Borges's stories, El Sur, to some kind, But I wanted to ask you, do you see anything, or have you thought about this, do you see anything of Borges in the character of Jorge Julio Saavedra in the novel?
Oh, I think it's a direct kind of parody, both an affectionate parody of Borges, absolutely, for sure, yeah. The whole machismo thing, the whole sense of the gauchos, I mean, that really just comes right out of a Borges. So I do think he's kind of paying homage and homage to Borges's role in Argentinian, culture and society, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you again, Mark. Thank you for your questions. So generous.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming through.